You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny, and you've reached the Reading Envy podcast, where we are having a joint read-along discussion with the Book Cougars. Hi, Emily and Chris.
Hello.
Hi, Jenny.
So nice to be back with you.
You as well. And we all can see each other today, which is nice. Recording from afar. And so this has been part of a joint read-along where on this podcast, we're talking about When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, which is a Norton anthology of Native Nations poetry, edited by Joy Harjo, among a bunch of other people. And we're also going to talk about the poetry handbook, or I guess it's called A Poetry Handbook by Mary Oliver. And then on the Book Cougars podcast, we're going to talk about Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. So I can post a link to that once that one is up as well. So this has been an interesting project. One thing that I really liked about the anthology is that it starts with a blessing. And since there's a poem that seems to bring the two books together, it's called Sweetgrass Is Around Her. We are going to do a joint reading of that to start the podcast episode. So go right ahead, Emily.
Yeah, this is Emily, just so you get to know our voices a little. This poem is called Sweetgrass Is Around Her. A woman was sitting on a rock. I could see her clearly, even though she was far away. She was Teohontasson, my mother's aunt. She was a basket maker. When I was young, my mother told me that her name meant Sweetgrass is all around her. I thought it was a good name for a basket maker. She was in her 80s then. She was short like me and a bit stout. She knew the land well, and the plants and the medicines and the seasons. She knew how to talk to the Creator, too, and the thunderers and the rainmakers. She had a big bundle of sweetgrass at her side. It was long and green and shiny.
Her big straw hat shaded her round face. It was very hot. She pulled her mid-calf-length dress down to her ankles, over her rubber boots. She brought her lunch in a paper bag, a canning jar of cold tea, fried bread, sliced meat, and some butter wrapped in tin foil. She placed them carefully on the rock. She reached into the bag and pulled out a can of soft drink. I thought it strange she didn't drink soft drinks. Then she reached for her pocket knife. Basket makers always have a good knife. It was in the pocket of the full-length canvas apron that was always safety pinned to her dress. She made two sandwiches, looked around, saw me looking at her. Her eyes sparkled. She smiled. She lifted up the soft drink and signaled me to come.
After we ate, she stood up on the rock and looked out. She smelled the air. I knew that she could smell the sweetgrass. I never could. She pointed to the very swampy land. Mosquitoes, I thought. I was dressed poorly. We didn't much talk, but we could hear and listen to each other. She never forced me to speak Mohawk. Mohawk with an English accent made her laugh. She didn't want to hear English, though. We would spend all day picking sweetgrass. Sometimes we would look for medicines. One time, my mother asked her what she thought heaven would be like. She said that there was sweetgrass everywhere and people made the most beautiful baskets.
That was beautiful.
So nice. I loved finding that in our anthology. It seemed like a nice connector.
For sure. And I don't think we said who wrote it. Should we say the author's name? Sally M. Kawanataki Benedict. And she sadly has passed away. She lived from 1954 to 2011. Beautiful poem.
Yeah. And funny, too. You know, it has humor in it, which I really appreciate. Because I think there is that stoic stereotype that at least people of our age generation grew up with you know, the stereotypes on TV. Mm-hmm.
So, how to even begin? This book is daunting. I think we had some people that started out with us that faded away, and some that are still reading even now. because this is, you know, this is a lot, especially for people who may not read a lot of poetry. How did you approach it when you tackled it?
What I did was I made little tabs on top of each region, because as for those of you who haven't looked at the anthology, it's broken down by regions and then by year within each region, kind of close. So I thought I would read it by each region. So I have little tabs in there. And then, of course, I have my side tabs. And I didn't read it that way. I thought I would. I thought I would just read it pretty methodically. But I ended up just jumping around a lot and discovering new poems, sometimes rereading the same poem. So I was pretty scattered in my reading. And I'm not done with it either. I think it's going to be a book that stays on my desk throughout the summer. And I'll pick it up here and there to keep reading. How about you all?
Yeah, I had the same idea as you, Chris. I was like, I'm going to be really organized. And then Jenny did such a great job of it. She has this Goodreads thread, you know, where she sketched out a plan for us. And that really helped me think through the anthology before I started to tackle it. But then I started to do the same thing. Like, I read the beginning of each section because I wanted to understand a little bit about the section. And then I would just kind of flip to a poem that was interesting to me and read it that way. And then started to mark. I, too, have like a gazillion things sticking. I'm showing them, you know, all the pages sticking out of my book. So I wasn't as methodical as I wanted to be. How about you, Jenny?
Yeah, I stayed with the linear method. More because I wanted to see if some of the areas had different themes kind of embedded in them, like if they had, or, you know, even just selected the poems from that perspective, just to see if we would notice or anything like that. I think some people did point out, I think it's the second section, which feels very political more than the others. I think all the poems in some way are a little political because we're talking about land that was taken away. That's like central to the story, you know. But it felt like there was more about the 70s and the 60s and the movements in those days. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I guess that's maybe the one thing I got out of it. But I also felt like some of the time, if I wasn't connecting to a poem, I just gave myself permission to move on because I am a person who would otherwise get stuck, you know, and then never finish.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So. Yeah. And then in situations like that, I could start becoming resentful about a book, which is so not healthy.
Right.
Yeah. And I just really, I don't know if other people agree with this, but I just think poetry is so much more subjective than other things. Like, it's so much more related to the person. And I'm much more likely to bail on poems than I am on a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yet on the other hand, it's not as big of a commitment, you know, to read a poem. So it's like, okay, turn the page. You're not in the middle of a story. Just start another poem.
Right.
Yeah. So
I also did think that the Pacific Northwest section seemed more geographically specific to me. I don't know why. I don't know if it's that geography has a specific feel to it, maybe. But I did notice that. So I do think it was helpful to have it set up in the sections. I just didn't read it that way as I expected I would.
Yeah. Well, and what was interesting is in the introduction, Harjo talks about how they set it up to follow one of the Native Nations' directional systems. Yeah, here it is. So she talks about, it's on page 7, if you wanted to look at that. She writes, because the land is central to culture and identity, we have organized this collection into 5 geographical regions. We employed the Muskegon directional path, which begins east to north and continues to the west and then to the south. Each tribal nation is very different in orientation, ritual, and practices. And then, you know, as we all know too, we saw similarities, but I thought that was an interesting way to organize it. And also, the Native tradition of honoring ancestors by structuring the book this way. They're even starting off conceptualizing it while honoring their ancestors, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought it's nice to have a reason. I do think it's interesting that, Emily, you felt like the Pacific Northwest was particular for a region. But like for me, that was the one where I wasn't sure about the Islander parts being interspersed. It was harder for me, but I think it's because I'm from the Pacific Northwest and we had a very local focus in when we learned U.S. history, you know, and then I've been to Alaska and like seen the Haida Gwaii and all that stuff. And so to me, those are such specific unique places that I was a little thrown off. Like I think I was about halfway through that section. And then I started skipping the Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders poems. And then I went back and read those because I was so tethered to the regionality idea. And that helped me actually, because, you know, if you think about like the history of that place, like Hawaii wasn't even a state until, is it 1960 or is that Alaska? I always get them confused. But, you know, that's such a much longer time for people to have been this cohesive culture without as much disruption. And so to match those up, it somehow didn't work quite as well for me or something. Yeah.
So do you mean you feel like it should have been setting apart? It should have been its own region. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think so. I just think the islanders have more in common with each other than like with the people on the land. Mm-hmm. Because the interruption of the Pacific Northwest continental people was, you know, as early as like the Oregon Trail and the fur trade, like very early on. And I think Hawaii was its self-contained nation a lot longer. I don't know. It just seemed a little uneven for me. I mean, I understand you have to group it somehow. But
right. Yeah. And she talked in the introduction about how that was the most challenging, the largest geographical region and the most challenging to try and bring together to represent it.
I mean, I'm happy they didn't leave them out.
Right.
Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting in the acknowledgments, and I don't mean to be skipping to the very end, but that they did talk about the regional contributing editors. It just made me wonder how they facilitated this book. And if the regional contributing editors just wrote, if they were more responsible for the, what would you call it, like the bios for each of the authors, or if that was a different editor. Do either of you know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to who wrote the bios, but I know that they let the regional editors choose the poems. I think she talked to that in the intro, but yeah, I'm not sure about the bios. And some of the bios, I thought, like for Paula Gunn Allen, I thought they didn't talk enough about the huge impact that she had on Native American literary studies. So that was interesting to me because I'm a huge fan of her work.
Well, and it also feels like whoever was selecting them had a deep knowledge, because I would look some of the poets I liked up to see if they had their own collections. And sometimes they weren't well known enough for that yet. So there's some deep knowledge of the history in that and the contributions in that area too. That person that you mentioned, Chris, I don't think I know who that person is. Do you remember what
Paula
section
Gunn
that
Allen,
was in?
Let's see. What page is she on? 280. She's from the West Coast, New Mexico originally. And she lived a lot of her life on the West Coast.
I guess all it really says is that she's widely known. But what does that mean?
Yeah, right? She's widely. Well, she wrote one of the first books that became a bit of a, I guess, a study guide on how to, you know, she laid the foundation for the study of Native American literature. And that book was Studies on American Indian Literature, Critical Essays and Course Designs. That was in 1983. And I became familiar with her in one of my graduate study courses on women in literature. And we read her book, The Sacred Hoop, Recovering the Feminine in American Indian Traditions. And then also, I love this book and had it on my bedside for the longest time. And I have no idea what happened to it. I don't know if I loaned it or who knows, but it's Spider Woman's Granddaughters, Stories by American Indian Writers. This is not poetry that we're talking about, but some of Paula Gunn Allen's other writings. And sadly, she passed away too young.
A lot of the authors featured in here had passed away. That was really surprising to me. And then I had a conversation with myself, like, why is that surprising to you? But for some reason it was. I don't know why.
I think that was surprising. And then I had posted this in the Goodreads forums, but the language translation stuff, I just felt like I had been biased and I just assumed everyone would write in English. And then I was so thrilled to discover that some of these poems were in translation, basically, because so many of the other poems are about the loss of the language, of the languages, really, because of the way that people were schooled. And that's a pretty frequent mention in here. And so then to see either people who have relearned the languages, even if they didn't grow up with them, trying to work with them in poetry, I thought that was also really kind of a nice moment.
Yeah, and I wish that I could have found a resource for hearing a lot of the language. You know, I know some people in Goodreads, in the Goodreads thread, were saying they had found recitations of them on YouTube and things like that. But I just wish there was a good Google Translate, and I have not been able to find one.
You know, this could be a case of archives to the rescue. I would think that in archives, there are probably oral histories, hopefully in the native language. That might be something to check out. So if you want to send me on a mission, Emily, just let me know what languages you want to hear, and I'll try and find them.
I'm absolutely certain that some of those wax cylinder projects must have recorded indigenous people speaking, because it was the older generations that had the language. Because when I was at the archives in Bloomington, Indiana, we had lots and lots of reel-to-reel tapes that had been wax cylinders, but mostly from like performances and dances. But I have the feeling, or I got the sense, at least one of the poems I looked up, and I'll never be able to find it, was written as a song to be performed with the traditional dancing. And so some of these poems connect to music in that way.
Yeah. And they have a rhythm as a result. Yeah. I think Mamaday's first poem in the beginning is a song, I thought. Prayer for words. Maybe not. Maybe I misunderstood that.
And it just makes me wonder, like, if I'm reading the poems too much through my Western literature filter, instead of hearing them how the poet intended. I think some of the time they're definitely written in that Western tradition because they've gone to traditional schooling and that's what they're doing. But then some of the time, I don't think so, you know, and I'm not sure I always caught it. This is how I question myself as a reader sometimes.
Yeah, which is good.
I really appreciated, Jenny, when you said in the Goodreads thread that you often read the poems out loud. That changed everything for me. I only read a poem out loud when I'm reading it for the podcast or something. It's rare that I read a poem out loud to myself. Mm-hmm. And so then I really started to do that, and it changed a lot of them. And then when I was reading Mary Oliver's handbook, she talks about the sensory experience of poems. And it made me realize, oh, even more reason to read it out loud, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the poetry handbook just for a little bit, and then we can return to the anthology. Because it's really more of a tool than like a book you would sit down and read for pleasure, right?
Right.
I discovered, by the way, that I already had a copy, so now I have two.
Well, it's little. It's easy to lose it on your bookshelf.
Yes.
I really appreciated that one of the main takeaways for me is she said, you need to read a lot. You know, it's just like how they say that if you want to be a, you know, a good writer of, you know, novels, or, you know, get out there and read novels. Well, she said the same thing about poetry. You need to be reading and reading and reading. And I thought, well, we're doing that. We're reading a big anthology. Yay, us.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I like too how she does give some suggestions on authors or poets, I should say, to read for different things, like contemporary poets and their way that they use language. And she lists some to check out. But yeah, this is definitely, it's a really smart and hard book to read if you really want to understand some of the things she gets into, at least for me, like with the different like iambic pentameter and the different patterns. You know, sometimes it's hard for me to understand it, or I start thinking about it too hard and I confuse myself. I don't know if you all have that problem, but I remember trying to study that in school and usually getting frustrated and quitting.
Well, sometimes I just don't want to. I just want to read the poem, you know, and I don't want to get too intellectual about it. So it depends for me. And there are some poems, like I have poems that I read every day. And then when you read it, you start to realize like, oh, I do see different things. And now that I try to read it out loud, then you hear it differently as well.
Yeah. And first of all, I wanted to say that I did notice, Chris, there's a Lucille Clifton poem in here. I wonder too, with any kind of criticism, how much an author or a poet is putting into something on purpose versus how it's just the lens that we see it through. Do you write the words because it has the rhythm, or does the rhythm come from the words? I mean, I'm not sure. And I'm always worried that I'll start being over analytical with what I read if I know too much about the framework of things. But I tried to see it more from an appreciation standpoint. Like if I know what onomatopoeia is called, then when I see it and it's really obvious, I can be like, oh, I know what that is. You know, that's so cute. Rather than, you know, well, this poem has 9 cases of iambic pentameter.
Yeah. Or the risk that we think we're smarter than we actually are. That can always happen too. You know, it's like, actually, that's not what the author was trying to do with this.
Right. Yeah, I thought it was interesting the way, and I don't know if this is a poetic convention, but it's on page 52 where she talks about the beginning of the line and the end of the line. And she actually genders them as masculine or feminine. That just, I thought it rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. I don't know how y'all felt.
She's old school, I think. There's another thing that she says that is problematic for 2 reasons with our collection. It's on page 11. She's talking about reading poems. And she says, in looking for poems and poets, don't dwell on the boundaries of style or time, or even of countries and cultures. Think of yourself rather as one member of a single recognizable tribe. Expect to understand poems of other eras and other cultures. Expect to feel intimate with a distant voice. And I was like, first of all, Mary, we don't use the word tribe like that anymore. It's not politically correct. But also, I feel like with these poems in particular, it is exactly the place and the time that matters. What do you think? Right.
Well, I think the thing with Mary Oliver, she's talking about the style of a poem less than the content. You know, she's all about the pacing of poems and the meters and the actual words and the imagery, as opposed to any type of political, geographic importance, which is so surprising since her own poetry is so grounded in very local, specific places.
And so close to nature, you know, as well. So it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I not that I need to be defending Mary Oliver, you know, and Mary Oliver's not with us anymore anyway, but that sounded a little crass. I didn't mean it to sound that way. But I think what she was trying to impart in that paragraph is just like, be a broad reader, you know, don't use too much specificity in what you pick up and try to read. But I completely agree with you that with our approach of what we're talking about, a handbook in companion to this very specific, in a certain way, anthology, that we are doing something that she was not talking about there in a certain way.
Yeah, that's totally true. I mean, this is Oliver's handbook is very much a general handbook about style, mm-hmm. and as opposed to any type of specific time or place. And she does say, I did like this line, I underlined it also on page 11. The truly contemporary creative force is something that is built out of the past, but with a difference. And that I liked. And that resonates with the anthology that we're reading, that all of these poets, I shouldn't say that, this is an assumption, but like, you know, poets reading within their own traditions, whether it's their specific nation or country or, you know, humanity, poetry like Shakespeare or something that is considered universal, you know, that they have that in their back, at their back, but then they're putting their own unique lived experience on it. So that to me resonated these 2 books together.
I also really appreciated in the next chapter on imitation, where she's talking about in the world of writing, imitation is considered to be the sin of sins, you know, but really that is really what most writers are doing is imitating, you know, and I thought that was really an interesting, and the way she said it was so Mary Oliver. I really appreciated her. She was like, too bad. I think if imitation were encouraged, much would be learned well that is now learned partially and haphazardly. That's such a Mary Oliver sentence. Like, you can almost hear her, some of her poems in that sentence, you know?
Yeah. And I think in general with poetry in particular, that's one thing, the more you read of it, it's not as obvious in the anthology, because I think it's when you dig deep into someone's works and you like read the acknowledgments and they show you how many lines they've taken from other people, how many structures they've borrowed, because it's like part and parcel to how they've learned to write in the first place. And it's almost like a conversation after that point. And I think, I mean, the poems, they're not linked for us in that way. Like there's no narrator saying this poet studied with this person over here. But I feel like you can have that sense with these poems too, because surely some of these people have been influenced by each other. It's just not as, you know, articulated as in some of those smaller collections. I always think that poetry is more like art than like other types of writing, because with art, that's how you learn too, right? Is by imitating and understanding what came before.
Well, isn't there some famous line? I mean, I don't have the number right, where there's like five stories to be told. They're just told over and over again in different ways.
Yeah. But yeah. And some people even say three, you know, the classic boy gets girl. Oh, no, boy wants girl, boy gets girl, boy loses girl. Of course, very heteronormative example. Yeah. But yes, you know, there's everything's been said before.
Right. Yeah.
We're just saying things in different ways these days.
Yeah.
Because we're all unique, you know? It's mm-hmm. true.
Yeah. That's right. We are.
We all mix it up together differently.
Well, anything else about the Oliver, or should we return to our poems?
Let's return to the poems.
So I wanted to know if you had any favorites.
Oh, so many.
Yeah, I have a bunch marked. One of my favorites is The Old Man's Lazy. This is by Peter Bluecloud. It's on page 33. And this is about an old man, an old Native American man. And he starts by saying, the first couple lines are, I heard the Indian agent say, has no pride, no get up and go. And, you know, speaking about the old Native American man. And then throughout the course of the poem, one of the things the agent complains about is the fence that's broken down. And, you know, you could at least fix the fence. And then you find out later that it's not even the Native American man's fence. It belonged to the white guy who used to live next door, who put up the fence and spent his life digging for gold on the property and just becoming angrier and bitter to the point where the old Native American man goes traveling. So he doesn't have to be around it. And then he comes home and lives there. And what I liked about it is just that imagery of the agent saying he has no get up and go. When if you look at that Western way of having get up and go, like the white neighbor did, where he fences off his land and fences himself in and is digging for gold and just becoming embittered and not enjoying life. And I thought, yeah, you know, that's a great commentary on Western culture and what get up and go does to people and their souls, basically.
I loved that one. That's a good one, Chris. I also loved on page 26 by Emily Pauline Johnson. I loved the song My Paddle Sings. Oh, I just loved it. I'll read just a little bit. West wind, blow from your prairie nest. Blow from the mountains, blow from the west. The sail is idle, the sailor too. Oh, wind of the west, we wait for you. Blow, blow, I have wooed you so, but never a favor you bestow. You rock your cradle the hills between, but scorn to notice my white lateen. And she goes out and paddles. I love it. I just love that one.
It felt like such a lullaby. If you read the whole thing, like mm-hmm. you can just imagine someone either singing it as a song or like chanting it to get mm-hmm. someone to sleep. It's so soothing.
Yes, mm-hmm. it is. Be brave, O paddle, be brave, canoe. The reckless waves you must plunge into, reel, reel, on your trembling keel, but never a fear my craft will feel. Mm. Love it.
Yeah, that was such a good one. And then I'm kind of late to the party, surprised. I had no idea that Louise Erdrich wrote poems. I've read her novels. So, and she wrote one, page 135, Advice to Myself. I love that poem.
Oh, I didn't read that one. I meant to look up her poems because I had never read any of her poetry either and didn't stumble across them. What page did you say?
It's page 134. Here's a slice of it, a little bit. Leave the dishes, let the celery rot in the bottom drawer of the refrigerator and an earthen scum harden on the kitchen floor. Leave the black crumbs in the bottom of the toaster. Throw the cracked bowl out and don't patch the cup. Don't patch anything. Don't mend. Buy safety pins. Don't even sew on a button. Let the wind have its way, then the earth that invades as dust and then the dead, foaming up in gray rolls underneath the couch. Talk to them. Tell them they are welcome. That's just part of it.
Sounds like my house totally.
Exactly, mine too.
It reminded me of I feel like you guys talked about this poetry anthology. It was earlier this year.
Oh, Barbara Kingsolver.
Yes. Doesn't it sound like her advice poems?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very similar style and they're around the same age, you know, mm-hmm. so that makes sense to me. I also really enjoyed reading her sister's poems because I didn't know she existed and they had such different styles, such different approaches. One of my favorites, and I think I'm a sucker for a really unique love poem, and it's Tanaya Winder or Winder. She was born in 1985. Goodness. This is the Plains and Mountain sections. It's page 167, and it's "The Milky Way Escapes My Mouth." And then let's see, at the very end, or how about the middle? "I can't navigate my way into understanding light years, how we let darkness slip in. Is it madness to wonder if it ever really happened? You, a shadow, never leaving until I inserted continents between us. I lost you in the crevice between night and day. You died while I was sleeping, dreaming of a galaxy far, far away where love eclipses."
That's beautiful. And that's an example of one of those poems that uses white space in a really interesting way. Yeah, that's a beautiful poem.
Two others. Well, two by Natalie Diaz, page 346. She's writing about her brother, or one of the characters in the poem is her brother. And I was just stunned by these two poems. It's "When My Brother Was an Aztec," and then "It Was the Animals." I mean, just the imagery and the anger and the rage and the heartbreak that comes through on these poems. They were just really stunning. You know, they're the kind of poems that I read and then I had to reread again immediately.
And I was I meant to look her up, because does she have some novels as well, or is she just straight poetry?
It's just, as far as I know, two books of poetry. Okay. And she's a MacArthur genius. So her more recent collection was called Postcolonial Love Poem, and she talks more about her, I don't know if she's married, lover / wife, I can't remember, and also playing basketball, which is, she was a really good basketball player.
Yeah, Old Dominion.
Another favorite of mine is John Trudell, page 123, "The Plains and Mountains." He was the spokesperson when they had the United Indians of All Tribes takeover of Alcatraz, which I practically know nothing about and I feel like I need to read about, but during the time of the American Indian Movement. So this is one of those that falls in that kind of political focus. He's talking in the poem about how he challenged the government and they locked him up and they treated him like he was nothing. And he says, "I felt pity for them, knowing they will never be free. I was their captive, but my heart was racing through the generations and memories of eternity." Oof.
Well, you know, talking about some of the, you know, the political poems and the poems of anger, and we talked earlier of Paula Gunn Allen, and her poem on page 280 speaks to the sterilization of Native American women. So this poem is the narrator, her grandmother and mother are all having a luncheon at some fancy pants place. And they're talking about this. And the mother says, you know, "It's the same as Nazi Germany. A medical holocaust," is the line that she uses. And it just made me think so much about so many of these poems and the introduction, you know, where Harjo talks about the holocaust that happened to the Native American population, to the indigenous population, I should say, when Europeans first came. And, you know, so much of that was a bio situation where disease and bacteria were brought over that decimated a population that had never had exposure to those. And I thought, you know, that is a medical holocaust as well. Unintentional. And I do know that there was intentional spreading of disease as well. And then obviously lots of direct murder. But I just thought, you know, we have to mention the Holocaust aspect of this and the mass slaughter of Native American peoples and how they were pitted against one another by the white settlers.
Yeah. Hyde Erdrich. I think that's how you pronounce her name, right? Yeah. Hyde. Maybe it's Heidi, but it's Hyde and then E period Erdrich. So I call her Hyde. Anyway, she wrote a poem on page 140 called "Preoccupied." And then at the end, there's something that says "Notes of Preoccupied Digression." And I highlighted this. It's the only thing I highlighted actually in the book. And it says, "Descendants of the indigenous population of the U.S. remain just a tad less than 1% of the population, according to the 2010 census. If you add Native Hawaiians to the total, we are 1.1% of the population. So we are, more or less, the original 1% as well as the original 100%. I just loved that.
Yeah.
So that speaks to what you're talking about, Chris.
I'm glad you had that marked because I remembered the statistic, but had no idea where it came from. That's what the thought that came to my head.
That's one of the challenges with this anthology. And I was thinking of you, Jenny, and I don't mean to, you know, put you on the spot, but it's like when you're teaching from an anthology, it must be so hard to figure out where you are and have all of that together.
I feel like people, if they're really doing it right, they're not using an anthology like this, right? Or if they are, they're like picking 12 things out of it or something. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that more is better as a teaching tool. If you're really going to dissect the craft and those kinds of things, you really need to take your time with it.
Yeah, I had some, you know, in school, some Norton anthologies, and it would be sometimes frustrating that you'd buy this book that's 1,200 pages long, and then the teacher would have you read 12 pages out of the whole thing. And it's like, really? You couldn't do one of those photocopy packets for us?
Seriously.
Right. But I was not an English major, right? I was a business major. And then I went back to grad school. I had a first run of trying to go back to grad school when I was a single mom, which lasted one semester, did not take. But I took a women in gender studies class, and it was my first exposure to a Norton anthology of women's literature. And it was the same experience, Chris. Like, we read two things out of it. It was this huge chunkster of a book that I donated. And now I wish I had it, you know? So it's funny because I feel like I would dip into it now if it was on my shelf.
I feel like I still have my Norton anthology from my English class up on the shelf, but I'd have to check. But what bothered me about it going back to it is that some things, it's just excerpts. So with poetry, it tends to include everything. But when it's literature, it's not. And I'm like, I would rather read, you know, the entire work.
Doesn't that remind you of when before audiobooks were the thing and they would always be abridged?
I'm so glad that's changed.
Yes, yeah. Me too. Ugh. I always wondered, like, whose job is it to choose what to chop?
If I had that job, I would be a huge procrastinator. That's all I can say. Yeah.
I would just take out a couple ands and thes and say, okay, done.
There's this book club that's been happening in Instagram, and it's two Indigenous women running it. And it's called Erin and Danny's Book Club. You can find it under that name. And so last year they led a read along of the Erdrick, the six, I can't remember what they're called. This year they've been doing a monthly memoir by an Indigenous person. And there's so many things that I feel like I've been thinking about from those books. So when I read these poems, because the themes are the same, and also the theme of intergenerational trauma, of course, is a really big one. But then also just this idea that time is different for Indigenous people. Like, traditionally, they think of time differently. They think of relationships differently. That, I think, comes across in the Erdrick novels, because the people they see, like, as if you're related to them, that's it. That's all they need to know. All those people that come through that tiny house in northern Michigan or wherever it is. But then there was this poem, I don't know if I have it marked anymore, but it was There Is No Word for Goodbye by Mary Tallmountain. And it was just very much about how there is no word for that, because if you have been in someone's life, or if you've been related to them, then you always are. And I just thought that that was such a lovely sentiment, but also makes the separation from the land worse. It makes the separation from each other worse.
Yeah. Is that the poem, or I'm not sure where I read it, about how there, in most Native Nation languages, there's not a distinction between maternal and paternal grandparents and aunts and uncles, that you're once you're an uncle, you're just an uncle or an aunt, which I really liked, because that is such a thing, at least in my neighborhood that I grew up in. Like, oh, your mom's side, your dad's side. You know, it was just a really important distinction to be made.
Yeah, it's not that one, but I remember that. That was really interesting.
Well, I did see a connection. I started reading Breeding Sweetgrass, and I did see a connection, like, immediately with one of the poems I had just read. And apparently I can only read books now by picking them up and poking around and not reading it from page one to the end. But the essay that starts on page 48, mm-hmm, in Kimmerer's book, Learning the Grammar of Animacy. And in that essay, she talks about going and sitting in the woods in this place in the pine needles and learning the language of that land. And there's a poem that I had just read moments before, Prodigal Daughter by Kimberly Wensot. It's on page 90.
That's one of my favorite poems is it? in the whole collection.
I love that one. And I read this one a couple times too. And there's, she's talking a lot about home. And there's one stanza where she says, "Once I thought I could settle into the arms of pine, hemlock, spruce, and icy river, but that has not happened yet." So just having read that and then picking up Braiding Sweetgrass and reading this introduction to that essay where she is sinking down into the land, I just thought it was a really great connection between the two books. I'm sure there's millions more.
There's a lot. And I'm picking up the book, but I'm mostly listening to the audio, and Kimmerer narrates. I just love it. She has a beautiful voice, and it's such an interesting book.
I'm looking forward to starting it and discussing that for sure.
Oh, I did want to give a shout out to Louise Erdrich's bookstore, Birchbark Books, in Minnesota. It's a beautiful bookstore. If you ever find yourself there, or if you just want to support a Native-owned bookstore, highly recommend.
That's where we got our copies of this anthology. We ordered it directly.
That's a great idea. Well, thank you both, Chris and Emily, for joining me to talk about this book and discussing the Mary Oliver as well. I know I'll look forward to the next one.
Yeah, this thank you, was Jenny. Great.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, I think I would have poked around in this without a read-along, but I think having the read-along really helped give it more context and helped me keep going with it. So thank you.
Yeah, and I just wanted to recommend for people who've maybe not made it through or just read a few, you know, that's okay. And pick your favorite. See if you can go find more poems by that poet. It's a great way to expand from the stuff that you connected to. It's always so great to talk to the Book Cougars, Chris and Emily. Now, I also had a read-along discussion with a few brave souls who showed up. I'm going to pull a few excerpts from that conversation of places where we got into some interesting content. So you might hear from Vinny, Karen, Sue, and Audrey. Today with us, we have Vinny from New Jersey, Karen from Maine/Texas, Sue from Michigan, and Audrey from Minnesota by way of Iowa. I'm glad to have you all here today.
Great to be here, Jenny.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I thought we could talk about, you know, what is your personal experience with poetry? Did you have to study it in school? Do you read it on a regular basis? Or was this a really new kind of challenge for you?
This is Vinny. And as far as poetry goes, I feel like I'm still at the point in my life where I've only dipped my toe in the water a little bit of poetry, which is just strange because I tend to enjoy it so much when I do read it. It's just that I feel like I haven't hit that threshold where I feel like I'm finding my favorite poets and, you know, kind of seeking it out more readily.
I'm Karen. I read a little bit of poetry. I read mostly fiction and nonfiction, but I try to dabble in poetry. My favorite poet is Tennyson, but I've been trying to incorporate some more contemporary poets these days. But I hadn't read very much Native American poetry, so this was a really great collection to dip my toes in.
That's interesting, Karen. Do you think some of the older poets in this anthology were more accessible to you since you like Tennyson, you know, some of the rhyming, more flowery stuff?
You know, I really found that I liked a broad spectrum because I was trying to determine, was there an area that I liked or a time frame? And I found I really had in terms of my personal preference, I found that I liked some from each of the different geographies. And some of the earlier poems I thought were fantastic, but then some of the really contemporary ones I enjoyed too. So that's the thing with my poetry taste. I think it really goes all over the map. Even though Tennyson's my favorite, I have quite a few contemporary writers I really like also.
So I'll go next. I wasn't an English major in school or in college. I was a business major. So I tend to be very logical in my approach to the world. And sometimes, like even with this poetry, when you offered up the Mary Oliver, like how to read a poem type of, I can't remember the name of the title exactly. I was almost drawn to that first, like I should know how to read a poem first before I read poems type of thing. And which is not what I want to do. I read poetry because I want it to speak to me and not try to under, because I, for the longest time, I felt like I couldn't read poetry because I didn't understand it. Like, well, obviously other people understand it and you don't get it, Audrey, so you shouldn't read it. But it's like, I finally realized over the years that you just keep reading poetry and eventually it'll come to you and eventually it'll speak to you in a way that all of a sudden you'll just go, aha. It's kind of like when you first ride a bike, as soon as you realize you're riding it, you kind of, you freak out and you're like, how did I know how to ride? In the same way to read poetry, as soon as you start understanding it or it speaks to you in a way, then you're like, oh my gosh, how do I know that's okay? When this book, I found this at the library when it first came out, and I read a few of the poems and they just were like, they just really spoke to me. And so I checked it out immediately. And I didn't read the whole book. I just read a few here and there because I, you know, with other library books, you have so many books to read. So then when you had this at a read along, I intentionally went and bought the book and I've really enjoyed it. So these, you know, a lot of the Native America, a lot of the earth and that type of thing really spoke to me. So I think for me, poetry, I just have to try it. And if it doesn't connect, move on. Don't worry about that you didn't understand that one poet. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't continue trying.
Thank you. I skimmed through the Oliver handbook and she talks about that in her intro about how poetry is partly that spark, but it's also all this craft. And so she really focused on the craft element in that book. So this is what rhythm and rhyme and...
Well, if you're a poet, I'm sure you need to know that and that makes your craft that much better. But as a reader, you know, I hope people aren't intimidated to not knowing what that all is at the beginning.
Yeah. And I almost don't want to read it from that angle. Like I want to feel it first personally, and then maybe I want to dissect it, but maybe I don't want to dissect it because I'm always worried it's going to ruin my enjoyment if I'm thinking about it from that perspective, I think. How about you, Sue? Do you read a lot of poetry?
I have been reading more poetry lately, and I really love anthologies of poetry because you get so many different styles, and I just felt this anthology was particularly relevant right now because I seem to have been reading a lot of Indigenous things, and this just fit right in. I felt sometimes that I connected with the older poetry because my favorite poets are older poets. I mean, I love Wordsworth. I love Frost. I did get a Frost feeling from some of them, and I know a lot of them are about nature. So it was a lovely experience. I'm not quite done with it, but I'm going to finish the whole book. I don't usually do that with poetry anthologies, but this one is just very compelling. And I think it will lead me to read more poetry in the future.
I think that's great to hear. And you're right. Like reading an entire anthology back to front isn't really the way we usually do it, but we did it this time. One of the things I was surprised about is how many of the poets I'd actually read before. Not a lot, maybe five, but even five, I was surprised. Mm-hmm. So I made my list for myself. So I'd already read, I read Chief Seattle in school, Layli Long Soldier, Natalie Diaz, Jake Skeets, and Joy Harjo. And I was like, I actually own some of these their collections, and maybe I'm drawn to them for some reason. And then I knew some of the poets as novelists. So Louise Erdrich, I just was part of this read along last year where I read six of her books. I'd never read her before. She's marvelous. And it was interesting to see how her writing translated to poetry, especially when you compare it to her sister, who's also in there. I thought that was interesting. And then Sherman Alexie, I know I've read his novels, but not, you know, I didn't realize that he'd written poetry either. So how about you? Did you have any familiar names in there, familiar poets? Had you read any of those poems before?
Well, I hadn't read any of the poems per se, at least that I can remember and that I know. But I, like you, I had read some Native American fiction. Like I've read some Erdrich, some Sherman Alexie. I'm trying to remember if there was anything else that I think that was it in terms of the ones that names I had read literature from before. But anyway, like I said, this was my first experience with poetry that certainly on a wide scale, like I may have come across a poem here and there in school, but it never like stuck in my mind. So say, oh yes, I definitely read that. It was very pleasurable.
Being from Minnesota, I definitely have read the Erdrich's books and poems, and also Jim Northrop, the Fond du Lac of Superior. I just, for some reason, when I read his poem and his bio, it just seems very familiar. So I have to go back and find out if I've read him before, I've gotten anything, or I've just seen his work around state or around town. But he was really nice.
I had one interesting moment where I would swear to you I've never read Louise Erdrich's poetry, except for I recognized a line from the end of one. It's in her Advice to Myself poem, where it says, "Don't read anything except what destroys the insulation between yourself and your experience." And I feel like either someone pulled that out and quoted it in like out of context, or maybe I had read poetry and had forgotten, or maybe this poem's in another anthology. I guess that could happen too. I really liked that one. So let's talk about regionality. So these poems are very specifically organized, first by region and then by date of the poet, not necessarily the poem. I was wondering what you thought about that. What worked for you? Was there anything that was awkward? Did you see any smaller themes within specific regions? Is there anything specifically about placeness, about Native Nations poetry that makes this work or doesn't? Whatever you think about this, I'd be interested in hearing about it.
Well, I found it a pretty effective way to organize the collection. I have to say, I personally didn't see a whole lot of, I mean, obviously I'd have to study it really intensely, but just reading it through relatively quickly, I didn't see that there was stuff that I could say, oh, wow, this is clearly, you know, a hallmark of the Southwest section. Or I think if I had to say that there was one that I thought seemed more thematically similar, I want to say, I think it was the Pacific Northwest section that seemed like they seemed to have more similarity of themes than some of the others. And maybe it was the Southeast section I thought might have been a little bit more politically charged in terms of, for example, the Trail of Tears. There seemed to be quite a number of poems that dealt with that. But I found that overall, I thought that each poet was more distinctive to themselves, as opposed to, you know, oh, I could say, oh, you know, this is from the East and this is from the North and so forth. So, but it was interesting to have it divided geographically like that.
I thought it was a nice idea because to break it up by region, because, you know, at the beginning of the book, Joe Hardrow talks about how as Indigenous writers, they're so grounded in the earth and their sense of place. And so for me, and maybe it's just for myself, but once I realized what, you know, section they were in, it just seemed like I could travel there myself in my mind, like trying to be there with them. And, you know, I've been at least enough of the country where I can kind of do that. And of course, in the areas where I have lived and I have a little bit more of a connection, that was even better. But it really grounded me in their love for nature and their love for, you know, their own sense of place and how that affects them and in their communities. So instead of having it just all over, not knowing where they're from, it just helped me. I agree with Karen that I don't think I could have, like, if you gave me a poem now, I don't think I could say, oh, they're from the Southwest, but it just got me there a little faster.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like Karen, I couldn't say like, oh, this style is reminiscent of this region or anything, but just like, as you mentioned, Audrey, like knowing that where they were really helps you put yourself in that area. And I think also the fact that it going chronologically in order of when it was written too gave you a sense of the time also. So I thought that was helpful, you know.
I was really thinking about this a lot when I got to the Southeast section, because I noticed that there were several poets in there that were put in that section because their heritage is Cherokee, but they had lived in Oklahoma their whole lives, or, you know, somewhere in the Midwest their whole lives because of the nature of that history. I couldn't decide what I thought about that. I mean, I know that the way that Native Nations people think, you know, time is a little bit different. But then I also know that these kinds of authors and poets sometimes get trapped by the expectation that they think that way too. And so I was going around in circles about whether I thought that made sense or not. There were a few in the Southeast that, like the one who had the Seminole background, like he lives in Florida, he's still been in Florida. But then some of the others, I was I was just kind of like, I don't know. I don't know what I think about that. Like, I know in the Pacific Northwest, you know, the smaller tribe that you came from, but then people have affiliated kind of with larger groups because they've moved around and then that becomes their identity. And so it does seem to be different in different places. And I just thought that was interesting. I would have liked to be a fly on the wall for some of those decisions. It'd be interesting to know how they came to that.
Going into this anthology, I thought that the poetry from the Pacific Northwest or whatever, however they classified that, I thought that would be, oh, I'd be able to recognize that. That's going to be so vastly different because it's not really in the contiguous U.S. I don't know why I thought that, but reading all of it, I agree with everyone. I don't think that I could tell by an individual poem where the poet was living. So I don't know that it was very helpful to me to have them in the different sections like that.
Yeah, because there's other ways you could organize an anthology. That's always the question of how you should organize it. And they could have done it by theme too, just by the themes of the topics of the poems, because poems, since they're shorter, are easier to kind of assign to one theme or two themes. For instance, I've kept encountering poems about language loss, about how words are different, that you can't really communicate them translated, or the belief of outsiders about the language and things like that. I mean, that's one of the themes of the anthology for sure, but that could have been a section if they had done it differently.
I agree.
It's been a while since I've read another Norton anthology. How about you guys? Are those all organized by date too? I don't remember.
I think they're kind of different. If I remember correctly, like some of them are done by date, but some of them are done by theme and so forth.
I have a Norton anthology of English literature, and it is done definitely by date. So oldest to newest.
But no regionality, just oldest to newest. Everything's right. English. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously.
Other than the regionality thing, in general, is there anything that you found surprising or challenging that you wanted to talk about? I know for me, and I know I posted about this in the forums, if you were active there at all, the first time there was one that was translated, I was like, oh, I don't know why I didn't think about it. But the fact that someone would have written a poem in their own language first and then have to have it translated into English was somewhat of a revelation for me. And so I really liked seeing how the words flowed differently in the different languages, and when a skilled translator, usually the poet, could communicate that in English as well.
What I found interesting are some of the poets from the, you know, the earlier years that were, you know, that might have been born with a white parent and an indigenous other parent. And so they spoke both languages. And I was curious when they said what they wrote their poetry in, either English or their language, and how that, you know, that's not really translated. That's your own thoughts, and just how it would be different if you're writing the poem in English as opposed to their indigenous language. So, you know, there's a few at the beginning that I caught that were that way, where they grew up with both languages. And to me, that would be an interesting to see how their poems differ when they write in their different languages as opposed to being translated.
Yeah, and I think poetry often uses the sound of a word to communicate more than just the meaning of the word. Well, and also the meaning. But I was remembering the Hyde Erdrich poem, the preoccupied one, the way she uses words to kind of have movement, even in English. It's river, river, river. I never, never, never. So even when it wasn't translated, the use of language is very interesting.
Well, I hope I'm not stepping on the braiding sweetgrass discussion, but I had read that first before I read the poetry collection. I was really glad that I did, because it really helped me understand some of the themes of the poems. And I did see that across all the geographic locations where themes that Ms. Wall Kimmerer had discussed in her book came through in several poems. So that was very satisfying.
Can you think of any specific themes?
Well, sweetgrass. And just looking, I wrote down some of my favorite poets and or poems. Like there was one called Weaving by Elizabeth Woody. And like I said, I don't have my book here with me, but I'm guessing that had to do with weaving. I think there was one they talked about, like the three sisters, the corn and the beans and the squash, and the language that came up in both Braiding Sweetgrass and in the poetry, just the connection to the land. You know, like there was lots of salmon came up quite a bit in the poems, and that was in Braiding Sweetgrass. And so there were just a lot of images and things that I just had a richer experience because I had read Braiding Sweetgrass first.
Do any of the rest of you have favorite poems or poets that you have marked in your anthology?
There's one that I marked, Jenny. I'm not sure if it was a favorite, but it connects back to what you were talking about before with Onomatopoeia. It sounded kind of similar. It's the one from week four in Sherwin Bitsui. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but it just has it looks like T-O in English. I guess it's a word for water, the word for water. And it's just vertically arranged on the page. So it's kind of like the sound that maybe a drop would make. And at first I totally didn't get that. I was like, what is going on with this one? That's just a vertical, you know, toe over and over again. But it made me wonder about onomatopoeia, because just not knowing a lot about the history of poetry, is this something that was just spontaneously invented just in all different areas around the world and just like one of those things? I don't know if anyone can educate me about that.
I'm looking it up in my poetry handbook. I mean, she mostly just gives examples of it, but I don't know where it came from. There's something called the ding dong theory. It's a theory of Carl Wilhelm Heise, supported by Max Müller, and it maintains that the primitive elements of language are reflex expressions induced by sensory impressions. So the first time the brain heard a phonetic expression that sounded like something else, it resonated, it helped them remember it. It's almost like a biological function of language. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's just so fascinating. And it would probably be something that's spoken first, but even in the Bitsui poem, when it's written on the page, it also is like having that visual representation too. So it's, yeah, that just really fascinated me.
Did any of you try reading any of them out loud?
I read a few on the way down to where we're at in Iowa today. I read a few to my husband, which I thought for sure he wouldn't be, you know, agreeable to at first. But then after the first couple, he's like, I can, yeah. So it was really interesting to do. A couple of my favorite poems actually were dealing with, I thought I would really resonate with the nature and that type, which I do. But I was actually drawn to more the ones that were talking about the boarding schools and some of the other harder subjects. I think they really affected me a lot. The one I really liked was Jim Northrup again. Looks like he's a Minnesota poet, but it was called Shrinking Away, where he talks about he needs to go, he gets back from Vietnam and he has his nightmares and he goes to his therapist and he doesn't connect with them, but then he realizes the therapist needs his help more than he needs it. And then at the end it says, that's when I realized that surviving the peace was up to me. It was a very nice poem, but it had some really hard subjects. But I just found that, you know, just realizing that we all have the same issues and problems, and it doesn't matter who we are, but we're humans, you know, and it just spoke to me.
There were a few that end up talking about being perceived as the enemy. So even though you're the person being oppressed and relocated and forced out, but then still being seen as the enemy, that I thought were really powerful too. Ended up being a poem of protest though. And it was pretty powerful. And I saw that theme a few times where you can think these things of me, but here's who I am. Kind of even just like in a quiet declaration that I really liked. But some of them came from people who were really active in the movement in the 70s. So I thought some of those poems were fun. Who has another one they like?
Oh, I happen to remember that I really enjoyed the one by Joy Harjo. She had some horses and it lists like a bunch of horses she has. It's essentially comparing horses to men and so forth. And then at the end, they were all the same horse, like that all the bad relationships she's had, they were all the same. I thought that was really funny. I enjoyed that one.
I like that one too.
So good.
I think I mentioned this one on the message board, When My Brother Was an Aztec by Natalie Diaz. It was one that I the first time I read it, I was just completely mystified. It was talking about how the author's talking about how her brother was doing all these terrible things in this kind of really fantastic imagery of, in terms of violent acts against their parents, and that brother was doing all these things and likening them to like Aztec sacrifices. And yeah, the first time I read it, I didn't know what to make of it, but then it was kind of like reading it and rereading it and just feeling the sense of like rebellion, like when an adolescent would kind of rebel against their parents and do all these things, and then the parents still love them and keep welcoming them back. And yeah, that was one that kind of just really impressed me.
So this is in the Pacific Northwest section. It's the Michael Wasson poem. I don't even know if I can pronounce the title. A poem for the Hawatnan and Hulalakapiks. The Holy Ghost of You, the Space in Thin Air. I'm going to hold it up a little bit because it's very fragmented. It's very contemporary in style. But he seems to be trying to kind of sort out who he is in the context of what everyone else thinks about him, about his background. And then the body, how does the body play into that? And I just like the end so much. It says, had this body been held after all these years, I would enter you to find my frozen self and touch. Like the gutted animal, we take an offering and live. So it almost ends on a little optimistic note, which I really liked. I probably read it 3 or 4 times just because there's so much in there. And trying to really, you know, grasp what he was trying to say. For some poems, that's hard. But for some poems, it's like, it feels like a good challenge. Like it feels good to work through it.
I have a question that you may know, Jenny, because there were a couple of poems. I read The Sharks in the Time of Saviors, and there were a couple of poems that suggested that was that sharks saving kids or saving people is like a motif in maybe some cultures that I'm not familiar with. And so I was curious, because I know you really enjoyed that book. And so I was curious, I didn't read the Tournament of Books commentary on that book. And so I thought maybe they've discussed that. And anyway, do you have some comments on that, Jenny?
I don't specifically remember what we said in the commentary for that, but I do think that in the context of the book, the sharks saving him meant that the old ones were favoring him.
I thought so too.
Yeah.
But weren't there a couple of poems in this collection where they talked about like sharks saving people? I thought there was a couple, and I was kind of like, oh, well, maybe this is some sort of myth that I'm not familiar with. But you haven't heard if that's a familiar like motif in some cultures?
It sounds like it would make sense. I'd have to do a little bit of research.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have in the poem by Abigail Chabanoy, at the end of her poem, imagine what it might be like when the waters come to be a fish, to be 12 strong, to be 6, 200 or 40 sharks swimming towards you. I think on that one, I was that kind of situation where the sharks aren't necessarily coming for you, but they're coming towards you.
It makes me curious. It makes me want to go figure it out.
I had a question about a poem. It was by Peter Blue Cloud. It's on page 37, and it's called Rattle. I didn't know how to read it. I wasn't sure if you were supposed to read one side of the poem all the way through and then go back and start on the other side, or if you read them side by side, or were they continuations of each other? I was a little bit confused, and so I didn't quite understand that poem. Anyone else have any thoughts about it?
Yeah, I read it as 2 separate poems also, because I didn't really know if that seemed to flow, but it just, yeah. I'm with you. I didn't know if I was doing it correctly.
Yeah, I know. Is there a correct way? I don't know, but it was confusing.
Yeah, same. In fact, that was one that there were a few of them that when I was reading them, I was like, oh, I would love to see a YouTube performance of this particular poem. And I think that was the one that I was absolutely like, wow, I bet this is really incredible to hear performed.
Would it be performed by 2 readers? or would that be too difficult to do?
Yeah, that was what I had questions about. I was like, you know, that's why I thought it would be so neat to see how the poet conceived of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it shows on his bio for Peter Bluecoat. It says that he was influenced by the beat culture of California. So maybe that could also give us a kind of a hint to where he was going with that.
What I was thinking about when I looked at the page is how when there's a dance that has a rattle, you have the sound of the rattle on the feet, on the ankles, at the same time that people are singing and at the same time that there's a drum beat. And so maybe it has a feeling of those multiple rhythms that coincide, mm-hmm. but also conflict with each other a little bit. I can kind of see it or feel it that way, but I don't know if I could pull it off. It's definitely not just to save space.
No.
And that's the thing about the written word of poetry is that there are some poems that if you only heard it, you wouldn't understand what was happening on the page. And sometimes the space on the page really matters. Because if you tried reading it like straight across the whole way, that doesn't work. But no. I've seen some poems that have gaps in the middle where it's not clear if that works or not, because it doesn't make sense either way. That Layli Long Soldier that's in here, that poem is pretty straightforward, but some of her other poetry is very much about the space it takes up on the page, and it can be very hard to break into it. Who else had things they were hoping we would talk about?
It was interesting what people thought about some of the ones that had some humor to them, especially because that it really goes against like that kind of stereotype about Indians or Native Americans being stoic. It was great to see that taken apart. And also some of them kind of went side by side with the protest theme. I mean, one of them that I really liked in the first section, The Real Indian Leans Against by Christos. I just, if I could just read a little bit of this one. So at the end of the poem, it's, "You too could have a fake Indian in your parlor who never talks back. Fly in the face of it. I want a plastic white man I can blow up again and again. I want turkeys to keep their feathers and the non-feathered variety to shut up. I want to bury these Indians dressed like cartoons of our long dead. I want to live somewhere where nobody is sold." So both funny and poignant at the same time. So I really thought that was well done in so many poems.
So I was wondering, did anybody find any difference between genders in the poetry here? Or like I said, I mean, I see that they have a lot of female poets in here, and I just didn't know if anybody found any difference.
Well, one of the poems I have marked is by one of the earliest female poets, Emily Pauline Johnson. Mm-hmm. And her poems were very much not what I would think of as being female poems. One of them is called "The Song My Paddle Sings," which puts her out on the water rowing her own boat. Mm-hmm. And I actually really liked that. There seemed to be a lot of independence. Not that that isn't a female trait, but I felt like both genders, or all of the genders, there's a few that are not just male or female. I mean, independence in thought and just autonomy comes across as something really important. And so I wonder if that changes the perspective of calling something one way or the other. I don't know. Did you have a thought about it, or people that you really noticed doing something?
Well, I was just wondering with Vinny was saying, where we have this perception of, you know, the stoic and just the female just being independent and strong and that type of thing. I was just kind of shattering just some of my stereotypes. You know, I found a lot of the male authors showing a lot of vulnerability in their poems. I thought that was nice too. It doesn't matter, I guess, whether you're what gender for that, but it was just interesting for me, because I tried not to look at first what they were. I tried not to read the bio first, and I just tried to read the poem and then go back to see who wrote it, because I didn't want my biases, whether, you know, of anything to fill in what they were saying.
Yeah, that's interesting about not reading the bios first. It was kind of, I haven't really read many poetry anthologies, but I never read it where you get like a little mini bio and then the work. Yeah, there were some times where actually I did read them first, but sometimes I forgot, and then I went back and I might be like a little bit like surprised that, oh, it's not the gender I thought it was, or something, or the age or something like that. So that is kind of interesting when that happens.
This is kind of a tangent, Audrey, but there's one poem that I had marked just for this one little segment of it. It's Adrian Lewis's Skinology in the Southwest and West, because he's at the end, he says, "She smiled at me and got off her horse. She smelled of leather and sweat, and her kiss has lasted me 50 years. And he also seems to also be talking about the going back, like being affected in a forced way by your external culture and then returning. And because he ends that poem with saying, "Bad Indians do not go to hell. They are marched to the molten core of the sun and then beamed back to their families, purified, whole and holy as hell." Mm-hmm. Just kind of like that sacrilegious bent there.
This is really a treat. I really enjoyed reading this, and I look forward to reading the parts that I didn't get to yet.
I almost wish this were more like we could do this over this like a semester, because there's so much we, you know, didn't get to talk about. And
oh yeah,
so many good poems in here, so many things to think about. Well, if we're to our ending, I was going to read a quote from the Mary Oliver book to send us out, if everyone feels like they've said what they want to say. She says, "A final observation. Poetry is a river. Many voices travel in it. Poem after poem moves along in the exciting crests and falls of the river waves. None is timeless. Each arrives in a historical context. Almost everything in the end passes. But the desire to make a poem and the world's willingness to receive it, indeed the world's need of it, these never pass. If it is all poetry and not just one's own accomplishment that carries one from this green and mortal world that lifts the latch and gives a glimpse into a greater paradise, then perhaps one has the sensibility, a gratitude apart from authorship, a fervor and desire beyond the margins of the self." That was a nice little send-off, Mary Oliver.
I really appreciate you picking a poetry book for one of your read-alongs. I thought this was a great idea. I've been trying to get my book club to read some to suggest maybe us doing a poetry book for a book club. Just, I don't get many takers.
Yeah, it's a hard sell for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Oh, and we were talking about how so many of us like anthologies to expose us to other works. Does anyone have an anthology they can think of that they have particularly liked, or a poet you want to recommend?
Not from poetry, but I think what it's done for me is it's made me want to read more books by some of the Indigenous authors described, or like when they do the Great American Poetry or short stories, to maybe get into some of those now that I've been introduced to it, thanks to you.
Yeah, and I know Heidi Erdrich, she also has a couple anthologies, some Native Indigenous, and I've seen them, at the bookstore, but I haven't, I'll flip through them, but I haven't bought any. But I feel like it's almost like buying in the old days when you would buy a record and you're like, "Well, but I only like one of the songs on there. I don't buy the whole book," you know? It's like, so it's the same kind of way I am that way with poetry books. It's like, well, what if I only like two of the whole book? Is that a waste of money, or should I get it? And so that's what's nice for me, anthologies. I just feel like I'll really probably like at least a third of them, and there's a lot of them in here. But I do try to, there's a couple of bookstores that really have strong poetry sections and I always try to at least try to find something, because I want to support local authors and poets. But it is kind of hard when you do take it home, you're like, "Oh, I only like three."
Yeah, I think one year I was at the AWP conference, which is American Writers and Writing Programs, and they had all these poetry readings. I just soaked it up. I mean, people like Dinez Smith and Morgan Parker, like all those better known people. And then of course you could buy the books, but I feel like after you've heard the poet perform their own work, it like leaps off the page more, for me anyway, like hearing it in their voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe that's what I should do, is maybe, try to go on Instagram or YouTube and try to listen to more poets and just seeing what comes out at me, and then go by their work.
And I think some people, I have one friend who always reads the National Book Award long list for poetry, which is 10 volumes. But I always find them really hard. Like, unless you're going to buy them for yourself, it's hard to find them. A lot of libraries don't buy that kind of stuff. I can try sometimes.
Do a lot of poets put their work out on audiobook? Do they do that at all? Or
some do. I know Mary Oliver did. Billy Collins always does, because he reads his own and he's hilarious.
Yeah, I like him.
I feel like Joy Harjo.
Yeah,
I think An American Sunrise was an audio,
and it's pretty powerful listening to her read it.
She has so much rhythm in her poems already since she's a musician. Sometimes when she performs them, she kind of dances a little. She's so great.
I'll have to do YouTube. I haven't physically seen her.
Yeah, she's all over YouTube since she's the, you know, poet laureate and stuff. She's done a lot of really public performances. But she also plays the saxophone, which I just love.
I didn't know that.
Before we go, planning to do another read-along in the fall of some kind. Are there any books that you would love to do in a read-along setting that you just haven't been able to get through? I heard what this is called the other day because I'm teaching my reading class and it's going to be one of the questions I ask students. They call it the white whale book, like the book you want to read, but it keeps getting away.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that they didn't want to read Moby Dick.
I think a lot of people it is Moby Dick, but...
I like that reasoning better, though.
Yeah, I have a lot of white whales, but...
Let me know if you think of any books that you're, like, dying to read, and I think I might do a poll this year, because I also have several that I should get to eventually.
Just looking behind me, like, well, there's a lot you can't see that are on the floor.
Does it matter with... Well, you've done long books, Gone with the Wind and things like that. You don't
I try to pick something fairly substantial, because I think the point... For me, a point of read-along is... to help get encouragement along the way.
Kind of space it out, yeah.
Yeah. So I have a few on my shelf that I've thought about from time to time, like Possession by A.S. Byatt, Sarah Waters. I can't remember which book I have over there, but I've never read her.
Fingertips.
Yeah, that might be. I'm not sure which one I have.
Yeah.
You know, books kind of like that length. I've never read Middlemarch, and everyone loves Middlemarch, but so many people have already read that one, so I don't know.
Yeah, I did that as a read-along.
Yeah, did it help?
You don't, absolutely. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have finished it.
Yeah, and I think Literary Disco did that one because I listened to their episodes about it. Well, thank you all for being here. And Tina, I'm sorry. Nice to see all of you. Hopefully, I'll see you next time.
All right.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode at readingenvy.com. And don't forget to check out The Book Cougars, the second book of the read-along, Braiding Sweetgrass. That episode will go live on June 8th. Thanks for listening.